So as the Buddha looked out on his experience and what he saw of others' experience, what he saw, what he came to is that life is full of suffering. There is just this endless supply of sorrow, grief, despair, frustration, depression. And he was curious, his mind was curious about whether it was possible to live a life without this suffering. And so he went off to explore this question. This was his kind of motivating question. What is this suffering and how can we end it? One of the keys that he came to understand in this exploration of suffering is that it is not so much unpleasant experience itself that is suffering, but rather our response to experience that we tend to have a response to what's happening with somehow feeling like it's just not quite right. It's not the way we want it to be. And that this sense that things aren't the way we want them to be is actually the root of most of our struggles, all of our struggles. So this is how he defined suffering, how he defined dukkha. He used this term, dukkha. I don't know if he was the first one to use this term, but the word in Pali, dukkha, many of you, I think, have heard this before, the derivation of this term, dukkha, comes from first the root du, the first part of the word du, which basically means bad, something like that. And the second part of the word, the ka part, is one of its meanings is the empty space in the middle of a wheel. So basically the hole where the axle would go through. And so if you have a wheel where the empty space in the middle is bad or off, whether it's off center, whether it's a little too tight, if that central place of the wheel is not a good fit, the ride is going to be bumpy. And so this is what I think this is actually a really good way to look at this term, dukkha, because as I said last night, it's not just the great, what we call suffering. I mean, the word suffering often has a kind of heavy connotation to us in English. But the connotation of this dukkha is much broader and much more subtle than what we normally think of as suffering. Now, it includes what we call suffering. It includes the devastation that comes when we lose a loved one. It includes the deep despair around losing a job or the pain of being in an automobile accident and the fear that goes with that around how am I going to support myself or something. You know, so it includes those deeper kinds of suffering. But it also includes just this feeling that things are kind of off. You know, it's just like things just aren't the way we want them to be. Got to have a little more of this, then things will be better. Maybe if I could get rid of that, then things will be better. So there's kind of another term, perhaps, for dukkha is unsatisfactoriness. We have a sense that things just aren't quite satisfactory. They're not quite the way we'd like them to be. So this is the mental reactivity, the mental response to experience. And this was, I think, a key piece that the Buddha pointed to, that it is within our minds that our struggle begins. The pain itself, you know, if we are in an automobile accident, the actual physical pain, the Buddha says, you know, we're not going to do away with that. There's no way to do away with that kind of unpleasantness in our lives. But the reactivity to that can go away. And that's what he was focused on. That's what his question was. How can that mental reactivity be released? So after the Buddha came to his understanding about dukkha and how to free himself in his own mind, how to free his own mind from this reactivity, he looked around at the way beings were behaving, the way people were behaving, and he saw that they were trying to become happy. They were trying to do things that would make them happy. But in actuality, they were doing the very things that kept them tied to this cycle of unsatisfactoriness. So the way we try to make ourselves happy, the kind of conditioned way, the way that we've been taught in our society, in our culture, and it's not just our culture, it's all human culture, back to the time of the Buddha, that we're taught that the way to be happy is to have the things that we want. Either physical things, surrounding ourselves with pleasant experience, pleasant people, getting rid of things that we don't like. So creating an environment that suits us is one way that we think we will find happiness. Another way we think we'll find happiness is by becoming someone that perhaps has respect or perhaps has fame, you know, by becoming a certain kind of person. So we try to acquire things. We try to acquire physical things. We try to acquire reputation. And these things, the happiness of this kind of action, this kind of activity, depends upon things that are unreliable. So what we're doing as we're trying to be happy in those ways, as we're, you know, trying to accumulate the things to create this environment that we would like to have and to create this sense of status, of reputation, of fame, of what we're doing with that is relying, putting our happiness on things that are unreliable. Things themselves, situations themselves, are impermanent. They're bound to change. And so if we are staking our happiness on something that is bound to change, we will suffer when it changes. We may suffer if we don't get the thing, too. I mean, that's another way that we suffer. We try to arrange the world to suit ourselves, and we find we can't do it. And then we feel like we're a failure. But if we do manage to, for some period of time, arrange the world to suit us and think, oh, now I figured it out, we're destined towards some kind of suffering when the situation changes. And the becoming someone, if you look in your own mind, you look at your own experience around the kinds of people, the kind of person you want to be, I'd say most of the time, or much of the time, that person is dependent upon being recognized by other people. So, fame, respect, those things depend on the opinions of other people. So again, that's not very reliable. That's pretty much outside of our control, the opinions of other people. So again, we're kind of destined towards relying on something for happiness that is unreliable. Not a beneficial course of action. So the Buddha noticed this. He saw this. The people doing the very things that will lead them back into this struggle. So what he realized is that there's a fundamental shift of perspective that needs to happen. And the fundamental shift of perspective is around how we think that we can be happy. And that this way that we've been trained, that everybody has told us since the time we were born, and actually our experience has somewhat confirmed since the time we were born, that having what we want makes us happy. There is some happiness that comes from having what we want. I'm not going to deny that. It is not completely bereft of happiness in that experience. But it is not a reliable kind of happiness. It doesn't actually last that long. There's one teaching that the Buddha offers around, particularly around sense pleasure. He says, yes, sense pleasures will bring you happiness. There's a kind of a gratification around sense pleasure. But what you should do with that, how you should explore that, is to recognize that gratification. Actually notice the gratification and see just how far that gratification extends. How gratifying is it actually to get what you want? So it can feel pretty good for a little while. But then things change and we realize, okay, well, having that new car, it made me feel really good for about 6 weeks, but now it's just kind of, it's just my car, So it's kind of more just in the stream of things. It's not productive of that same kind of happiness. And what seems to happen for us when we get to that kind of space where it's just things are kind of normal as is, we want that hit of something making us feel that happiness again. And so we go off looking for something else to want. This is the cycle that the Buddha said beings are on. Essentially, living with this motivating view that having what we want will make us happy means that since that happiness of having what we want only lasts a short time, that then we have to want something else in order to get the happiness of having what we want. So this is the area that the Buddhists, we really need to do a 180 on in terms of our perspective on this situation. The Buddha proposed it's not from acquiring things or status that true happiness can come, but it's rather from letting go. It's not the not having that brings suffering. We think it is the not having, that if things aren't the way we want them to be, we don't have what we want. We think it's the not having that's the problem. Rather, the Buddha proposed, it's the wanting to have that's the problem. That's where we really need to shift our perspective. That the happiness doesn't come from having what we want. It comes from letting go of the wanting. This is a real fundamental shift. And it bears out with our experience. If you look, if you watch in your experience, what happens when you want something? You know, there's a real sense of things feel off. That's the real, that's the offness. You know, the feeling of wanting, inherently there's a lack. There's a feeling of lack. Something feels like there's something wrong. If you can just hang out with that feeling of lack. So this is where we turn. This is, again, the shift of perspective. We turn from our direction being looking out in the world to solve our that sense of lack, and instead turn and look at that feeling of lack itself. If you watch that feeling of lack, that feeling of wanting, it's an impermanent state. It won't last forever. And if you get to watch it disappear, you get to see that wanting, that feeling of lack actually end, you'll see the happiness of the not wanting. And actually, in my experience, you know, that there's times when I've really seen that wanting, that craving, just vanish in a split second. And it feels like being let go of from a vice grip. It's the wanting that is the source of the suffering, not the not having. So this fundamental shift of view about where happiness comes from, where true happiness can come from, is the wisdom, the wise view that the Buddha offers us. So the traditional or classic definition of wise view is stated in the Four Noble Truths. The truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. The truth of suffering is this truth of dukkha that I talked about earlier. The truth of that it is this mental reactivity that is the suffering, not so much the problem, that there's not so much, it's not so much the unpleasantness of the situation, but it's our response to it. That's the truth of dukkha. The truth of the cause of dukkha is this craving, this wanting, this feeling of lack itself is the source of the suffering. Not because we don't have what we want, but because the feeling of lack itself is motivating or spurring that reactivity. So if we can let go of that wanting or see it release, the suffering won't follow. The truth of the cessation of suffering is the promise, actually, of the Buddha that, yes, it's possible. He says, I've seen it. I know it for myself. It is possible to become free of mental pain and grief, completely free of mental pain and grief. I find that very inspiring, a very inspiring way to look at that third noble truth. Not just freedom from suffering, but completely, utterly, totally free from mental pain and grief. Just imagine. I mean, even just the thought of that seems pretty amazing, that possibility. The Buddha says that's possible for us. And then the fourth noble truth, the path leading to the cessation of suffering, this is what he suggested we need to do, to take action in order to cultivate, understand, to see this ending of suffering. So the Eightfold Path is our practice, basically. So a rephrasing of this, of the Four Noble Truths, kind of succinct, I think. I just came up with this tonight. So this feeling that things are off, that things aren't quite right, is created in our own minds. And it's possible to change our minds. That's what the Four Noble Truths tell us. It's really good news, actually, that this suffering is created in our own minds, because that means it's possible. It's possible to change it. So there are another way to look at wisdom from a completely different angle of wisdom that the Buddha taught. So there's this teaching on the Four Noble Truths, which encompasses, he said, encompasses all of his teachings. So any teaching that the Buddha offered, you can find fit somehow into the Four Noble Truths. He also said that there are different kinds of wisdom. That there's a kind of wisdom that is come to by listening, by reading. So by taking in information, basically. There's a kind of wisdom that comes to us by reflecting or thinking, engaging with our intellect, actually thinking over what we've heard. So not just simply taking things in and just saying, okay, belief, I believe that, but actually reflecting, does this make sense to me? How can I understand that? So there's a kind of wisdom that can come from that as well. The third kind of wisdom is the wisdom that really begins to free us. These first two kinds of wisdom begin to, perhaps, if we hear something, hear a teaching that inspires us to reflect and think and say, gee, you know, maybe this would be helpful. It motivates us to act. And the wisdom that comes through actually engaging with the teachings, the wisdom of mental cultivation, is what leads to the direct understanding of the teaching, so that the wisdom is no longer the framing, perhaps of the Four Noble Truths, is no longer simply words in our mind or even just reflections and thoughts, but actually realize directly for ourselves, this is possible. We directly understand the suffering. We directly understand how the reactivity in our minds results in our suffering. And through that direct understanding, there's a beginning to let go. And so we directly feel the letting go of that reactivity and directly experience the release from that reactivity. So this third kind of wisdom that essentially we need to engage somehow meets the Four Noble Truths in that the Buddha said that these Four Noble Truths aren't just meant to simply be believed. He gave us actions to go with each of these Noble Truths. He said we should understand suffering. And understanding here means turning to meet with mindfulness in that way I talked about, turning to look at that feeling of lack. Instead of being focused on what is lacking in the world, turn to feel that actual feeling. The mindfulness, the recognition of that is kind of the felt sense of, oh, this is suffering. That's what's meant by understanding suffering. We begin to see as we explore our experience in that way how our minds do this. And because we see how our minds put this together, our mind then learns and begins to see how it doesn't have to put it together that way anymore. It seems kind of magic, but it's really just pretty straightforward, actually. We don't actually have to do this so much. We bring our attention to experience. We don't have to let go. We don't have to fix ourselves. If we turn our attention to our experience, the mind, in seeing how suffering is created, the mind itself will start to let go of those creations. Because I think inherently, the way we're put together, the way our biology is put together, the way our being is put together, we essentially want happiness. Now, we fundamentally misunderstood how that happiness is to be found. But when with mindfulness we turn and we actually see, oh, the way that I've been doing things, the way that the engagement that I've been in actually creates more and more of this feeling of lack, as the mind begins to understand that, and there doesn't have to be a you in there doing anything, that the mind can see this all by itself. The mind sees that doing of that creation of wanting, it starts to recognize that leads to suffering. And because we inherently kind of want to move to happiness, it starts to let go of the things that result in suffering through this understanding of suffering. So we understand suffering. Then I've just indirectly been talking about the action associated with the second noble truth, letting go of the cause of suffering. And again, this letting go, sometimes this letting go can seem like it has an active quality to it, but most of our practice, I think much of our practice is actually about letting be. And in the letting be, in the turning towards the suffering, we find that the letting be gives the space. If we can allow suffering to be without reactivity, it's like, oh yeah, there's anger again, but not react to anger. We can have that space around our suffering. We'll start to see that it will unwind. It will let go of itself, if only because it's impermanent. And so the letting be starts to encourage this letting go. And then the cultivation of the Eightfold Path, actually the cultivation of the Eightfold Path brings us the tools for helping us to understand suffering and let go of the wanting, this feeling of lack. So practicing the Eightfold Path leads us to this realization that it's possible for this suffering to end, for this dukkha, this feeling of offness, to come to an end. So the practices of the Eightfold Path, this is what we're actually doing here. We're practicing the Eightfold Path. The first two aspects of I'll just say them all just briefly. So the Eightfold Path is wise view, wise thought or wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. So these first two, wise view, wise intention, I've been talking about those actually quite a bit, particularly the wise view, the wisdom that we need to begin this path with. This path begins by hearing some teachings, hearing the words of the Buddha and having some reflection on them. These first two kinds of wisdom, hearing and reflecting. And we may think, maybe I'll try this. In my own experience, I know that when I kind of hit rock bottom in terms of suffering at one point, and it was at that point in hearing something about the teaching of the Buddha, I thought, well, nothing else has worked. Might as well give this a try. And it was very counterintuitive to me. I mean, the one little tiny piece of wisdom, and actually I think this is an important piece for us because, you know, wisdom, we think of wisdom as some big thing. You know, we think of it as like this, you know, we have to understand all of the teachings of the Buddha and then maybe we can start to engage. But the wisdom of the Buddha is really dense. You know, it just takes a little bit of it, a little tiny bit of it, and you can go a long way with a little tiny bit of the wisdom. And so when I hit this rock bottom, somebody had sent me a book about Buddhism and practicing. It was Everyday Zen by Joko Beck. And what I took out of that book was something along, I didn't understand most of what the book said. I mean, it was all very counterintuitive. But one thing I took out of this book was, why don't you try just noticing your emotional reactivity rather than acting on your emotional reactivity? It's like, well, okay, and it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Why would I want to hang out with emotional reactivity? But I thought I'd give that a try. That one practice, and particularly working around it with the experience of anger, which was my main difficulty at that point. Using that one practice of turning to observe anger instead of acting on anger or letting it continue, you know, in thoughts. The acting on anger can also be letting it continue to spin, churn thoughts in your mind. Instead of doing that, just turning to the feeling. What does it feel like to be angry? I remember the first time I actually remembered to do this, It's kind of like, oh yeah, I said I was going to pay attention to this. Oh, this is horrible. Oh God, this feels, what do I do with this? You know, I had no idea what to do with that. I had very little instruction. I'd read this book. I didn't know anything about paying attention to the body. But all I knew at that point was like, yeah, I'm angry. Okay, yep, boy, this doesn't feel very good. That's about what I could do with it. And over the course of a couple months, I began seeing how it unfolded, that there was more and more space around that anger, less and less reactivity. I began to not be so non-functional when anger arose. It was much more kind of normalized anger. And so the whole process, just that one little instruction over a couple of months, actually led me to some very profound transformation around my anger. So that, you know, the wisdom of the Buddha, a little bit of it goes a long way. You know, it might be as simple as, you know, turn towards the experience of dukkha instead of endlessly trying to manipulate your environment. From that little bit of wisdom, even just a tiny bit of wisdom, we begin to kind of align our intentions to act in the direction of that wisdom. That's what it did for me. It's like, okay, I'm going to try this. The intention was aroused to act. And this is wise intention, the second aspect of the Eightfold Path. It orients us towards acting in a way that will reduce suffering in our lives and in the world. And so it orients us towards letting go of things that create suffering for us. It orients us towards kindness, towards compassion, towards others. So with this understanding, we start to behave more skillfully. The intention is pointing us in the direction of behaving more skillfully. And this is the next aspect of the Eightfold Path, the aspects of wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. So our engagement in our lives begins to follow those actions. These actions of wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood are essentially about non-harming. And they're very much resonant with the precepts that we took last night. And so we are engaging in this aspect of the Eightfold Path by engaging in those training precepts. Moment to moment, we are refraining from taking life, refraining from taking what's not given, refraining from false speech, refraining from misuse of our sexuality, refraining from intoxicants. And so this ethical conduct, this outward behavior, can begin to have a rebound effect on our mind, actually, especially when it's imbued with this intention towards non-harming, the intention towards freeing our minds from suffering. When we're acting in a way that's in line with those intentions, those actions themselves begin to reverberate in our minds. And so it begins the process of cultivating our minds, letting go at a deeper level than the level of action, of the sources of greed, aversion, and delusion. And this is the last aspect of the Eightfold Path, the aspect of wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. This is really the heart of what we're doing here on retreat. Wise effort is really, the definition of wise effort is completely entwined with the notion of wise intention, with wise view. Because wise view is really about understanding what leads us to suffering, what leads us towards suffering, and what leads us away from suffering. So beginning to understand suffering and seeing the cause of suffering gives us a sense of what kinds of mind states send us on this spiral of wanting, of things feeling like they're just not right. I just got to fix this situation here. So the definition then of what is skillful behavior becomes entwined with what will free us from suffering. And what is unskillful behavior is what leads us back towards suffering. And the simplest definition I know of is that skillful behavior, or let's say non-skillful behavior, unskillful behavior is that behavior that's motivated by greed, by aversion, by delusion. By greed, by wanting things to be a certain way, by aversion, not wanting things to be a certain way, by delusion, being confused, being misinformed. That whole notion of where happiness comes from, that is one of the fundamental delusions of our life. That we think we can be happy by having what we want. That is delusion. So the effort aspect of the Eightfold Path is meant to support a cultivation of the skillful states and letting go of the unskillful states of mind. So while the second part of the Eightfold Path of ethical conduct is about cultivating ethical behavior, what this third aspect of the Eightfold Path is about, the wise speech, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration, what these three components together are about is cultivating a skillful mental landscape. So that wise effort is about cultivating in our minds those skillful states of mind that lead us away from suffering, and abandoning those states, those unskillful states of mind that lead us towards suffering. This needs mindfulness in order to know when we're engaging in unskillful behavior or skillful behavior. So this is wise mindfulness that supports wise effort. And the two of those together, wise effort and wise mindfulness, bring us to a place where the mind becomes settled down. Effort and mindfulness together bring what's called wise concentration. This concentration in this practice that we're doing is cultivated in two ways, through a stability of mind as we're coming back to the body and breathing over and over again. That cultivates our mind stabilizing. The mind kind of settles down when we just let go of what's not the body and breathing. So that's one way that concentration is cultivated. The other way that concentration is cultivated in the practice that we're doing here on this retreat is through the continuity that we've been talking about, through practicing moment after moment, not necessarily always with the breathing, but with the walking, with the eating, all through the day. Going to the bathroom, you can be mindful going to the bathroom. It's even in the suttas. Be mindful while urinating and defecating. That's actually in the suttas. Be mindful while eating, while walking, while reaching, extending, while contracting your arm. Just the mindfulness of everyday activities, moment after moment, cultivates this concentration. And the purpose of this concentration isn't the concentration itself. It is because the mind that is concentrated, the mind that is seeing moment to moment the experience as it unfolds, can see exactly how the mind is putting suffering together and how it can not do that. So it's this continuity of mindfulness that brings the power of mindfulness. The continuity, the concentration brings the power of mindfulness to actually allow us to understand this wisdom for ourselves. Whatever little bit of wisdom you resonate with, for myself, that little bit of wisdom around not acting on emotions came to a fruition one evening. I was cutting an apple in my kitchen and saw my mind produce a thought about the person I was angry with, saw the mind kind of inclining in that direction to pick up that thought, think more thoughts in order to get angry. Having spent so much time paying attention to anger, the mind knew that way lies suffering. The thought arose in my mind, I don't have to go there. I didn't really believe that thought because I'd never seen my mind not able to go there. But it didn't. It didn't go there. And in the next moment, I sank to my knees in gratitude. Because I knew in that moment I had found a way to the end of suffering. It was such a powerful realization that the mind, through this discontinuity of awareness, can see what it saw. It saw the mind kind of heading towards suffering. I didn't do anything, really. I just kind of was being present. The mind itself let go of that direction because it knew, deeply embodied, what that suffering of that intention led to. So this is what our practice supports. This kind of continuity, the settling, supports our being able to see these things. Now, some of this means that we have to be with suffering. You know, it's not a mistake. When we're noticing suffering on retreat, and you will notice a lot of it, it's not a mistake. It's actually our training. If we cannot have reactivity to that suffering itself, that way lies freedom. So one more piece I'd like to just bring in. This is a part of the Eightfold Path that I particularly find inspiring for myself. There's a way that the Eightfold Path is understood to be the practices that we cultivate, that we engage with moment to moment, as I've been describing. This is what we're doing on this retreat. Practicing wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration, using wise view and wise intention to direct our exploration, allowing ourselves to not be engaging with unethical conduct. All of those things. We're practicing all of those things. There's another way to view the Eightfold Path, and that is as the natural manifestation of someone who has completely let go of craving. It's talked about this way in the Buddhist texts, that someone who has been freed from this misperception around wanting, someone who has completely understood how that all functions, no more craving in their life, they naturally have wise view and wise intention. They naturally want to behave ethically. There's no wanting about it. They just do. They naturally behave ethically. They naturally engage with wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. It's just the way they are. So from this standpoint, you know, we can think about what we are doing then is kind of following in the footsteps of those people who have become free. The Eightfold Path, you know, this is a path analogy. How is a path created? Think about the paths on in the trails up here. Paths are created because people walk on them. And so people who have understood this have been walking on this path and are clearing the trail for us so that we can follow. So they are cultivating the path by living the path. And we are cultivating the path by actively engaging in it. So from this perspective, the path, the Eightfold Path, can be kind of seen. What we're doing in engaging with the Eightfold Path is modeling the behavior of people who are enlightened. And there's actually a teaching along these lines, and it's a beautiful, I find it very beautiful, poems. These are in a very old text. Some of the scholars think this may be one of the earliest texts written. And in fact, there's some evidence for that because it's one of the few texts in the suttas where people talk about. So do you know that sutta? It's one of the few ones that people actually talk about. Have you memorized this sutta? Do you know this one? So I'll read you some excerpts. This text basically it's a set of poems on clinging and freedom from clinging. And there are some of the descriptions in these poems are about what it's like to cling. You know, what's the life of somebody who's clinging like? You know, the struggles of that. And then there's the other side of it. What is it like when somebody is free? So the Buddha is asked a question. Tell me about a person who is completely peaceful. What is that person like? And then other questions. You know, so how do you get there? What's the training? How do you get there? And in these poems, it doesn't talk about the Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path, but it talks about very down-to-earth qualities. The person who is enlightened has certain qualities. So I'll read some of this to you. So the questioner says, having what vision, being of what character, is one called peaceful? Tell me about the Supreme Person. And the Buddha responds, a person who is not angered, not frightened, not boastful, and not worrying, who gives wise advice, is not agitated, is careful in speech, a sage. A person who does not cling to the future nor sorrow over the past, who finds seclusion amidst sense contact and is not led astray by views. A person who is retiring, not deceitful, not covetous, not selfish, not impudent, not arousing contempt, who does not engage in malicious speech. A person who does not relish pleasure, who is not conceited, who is mild and of ready wit, who is not credulous and not bored. A person who is even-tempered, constantly mindful, who does not suppose that anyone in the world is his equal, better, or lesser, who is free from conceit. This is someone I call peaceful. One who has no yearning for those things of which either ordinary people, contemplatives, or religious people might talk. Therefore, one is undisturbed by their banter. One sees that nothing in the world belongs to one, does not grieve over what does not exist, is not involved with these phenomena. This one is called peaceful indeed. So pretty down-to-earth description, you know. I like that. You know, it's very much what this description sounds like to me is very realizable in this life. Not something perhaps far distant. The training that is described. Some of this will sound familiar to you. What should one do? Tell me about the path of practice. A person should not have covetous eyes, should close her ears to ordinary chatter, should not be greedy for flavors, should not cherish anything in the world. In whatever way one is affected by sense contact, one should not lament over anything, should not long for continued existence, should not tremble amidst danger. Being meditative, one should not be footloose. One should desist from worrying and not be indolent. One should live in lodgings where there is little noise, should not be given to oversleeping. Being zealous, be given to wakefulness. Should abandon laziness, deception, merriment, various kinds of amusements. One should not be a boaster, should not speak scheming words, should not make a habit of impudence, should not utter quarrelsome speech. One should not be moved to tell lies, should not be deliberately treacherous, should not despise others for their way of life, for their wisdom, or for their moral conduct or religious practices. If contemplatives or ordinary people irritate one with their talkativeness, One should not respond harshly, for the peaceful do not retaliate. And then this is what I think really summarizes the whole thing. With regards to the teaching, one who is diligent should constantly venerate it by following the Buddha's example. So we live a life that models where we're going. So the path itself is a model of the freedom. If you want to be peaceful, behave peacefully. And you will find this has a rebound effect on your mind, kind of like I talked about before. So let's just sit for a moment.